Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen. Daniel Harford, out of action, ill. Dramatic scenes yesterday. Those scenes have continued today. He hasn't bounced back as we thought he would. So again, he's on the sidelines. He's not quite mentally strong like others that can just push through these sorts of things. We've got a busy show this morning. Rama, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
You're back.
Well, I am back, yes.
A couple of weeks ago, all over again.
I think our man Harvey may need the physical examination at the doctor's. Let's just see what the real issues are here. He bolted out of the studio yesterday and looking white as a ghost. And then at the 7 o'clock news, we saw him all tucked up on the couch and he was in trouble. He was in trouble, the young man. So... Look, we wish him all the best. I know he'll be listening now in bed with his, I reckon he's, well, what do you think, a cup of tea?
There's no chance he'll be listening. He'll be asleep.
Nah, he would have slept all day. Or will he go straight with the chicken soup, chicken and vegetable soup?
He's still not sure what's wrong with him either.
No, that's a concern.
He thought it may have been the Sunday night curry.
Curry.
But I'm not sure that's the case. So, yeah,
fingers crossed for our men.
Yes, very much so. Big show coming up. We're going to be joined by Ben Everill shortly from over in the US after the incredible performance from John Rahm. We'll talk about that shortly, but winning the US Open yesterday, the first Spaniard to win the US Open. Johnny Ralph will have all the latest footy news after 7. Kyle Adman has just re-signed at the South Melbourne Phoenix, so it looks like they're going to have a pretty similar sort of squad to the team that very nearly got into the grand final series in the NBL, with Mitch Creek also re-signing recently. The Inner Sanctum this morning, Shane Edwards from the Tigers. Really looking forward to catch up with Shane because so much has happened since we last caught up with Shane. Rodney Ead will join us after 8 o'clock. All issues in AFL football with Rodney from a coaching perspective. And then before the end of the program this morning, John Aloisi, former footballing legend when it comes to Australian football, but he's also part of the Optus sport team, which is, they're covering the Euros, and there's plenty to talk to him about with the Euros, particularly tonight with England in action, and they need to turn things around. They're going okay, but not going great. Yeah. But there's high expectations on England, and they play again tonight. So plenty to get to this morning. Where do you want to open the batting, Rama? I'll leave it up to you.
Do we start with a little bit of Carlton from yesterday? Now, I thought it was very interesting. So they roll out, obviously, the captain, Paddy Cripps, and then the vice-captain in Jacob Wietering, and then Liam Jones. So probably three of their more experienced or most experienced players to explain, I think, what was happening at the, or what's been happening at the Blues. And it's interesting. Like, you listen to those press conferences and it's probably all the same. You know, it's the same things. We're in this together. We're this. We support each other. We're that. But I probably wanted a little bit more, to be honest, yesterday.
All right. Well, let's have a listen. Firstly, to Patrick Cripps on both the Blues and then also, more specifically, on David Teague.
When results don't go your way, it can be frustrating at times, and guys can lose a bit of confidence. But like I said before, what I spoke about before is you've got to clear focus as an individual and clear focus as a team, and you've got to stick together. We'll review today's game pretty heavily, but the most important thing, we come out and train and we stick together as a group and have some fun. And we'll turn. It's a week's a long time of footy. I know a lot of teams say that, but it actually is, and I know I've got a lot of belief in this group. A few beers never hurts that. It's just things like at training. When you're training, you're doing it with purpose, and you're on the edge. When you're in the change rooms, you're still doing your weights and things like that. But you want to create an environment where everyone enjoys coming in. Credit to this group. One thing we always do is do that. We're a close group, and we do have a lot of fun. Things aren't clicking for us at the moment, but they will soon. When I say the group, I mean that as coaches as well and footy staff. It's clubs are unified. They stick together. Teague and the coaching staff is working hard as us as players, and that'd be just as frustrated as we are. So we're all in it together, and we'll find a way through together.
Carlton fans, give us a call if you want to get involved. 1300 652 927, or send us a text 0416 90 50 52. That was the co-captain of the Blues, Patrick Cripps. Did you like what he heard, or did you like what you hear? What do you want him to say?
Well, Rama? It's all stuff that I expected him to say. There's no doubt about it. But you want to you probably want to hear around, well, you know, why is it 41 tackles? Why haven't 12 players laid a tackle in the first half? You know, that's not good enough. We spoke about that after the game as a playing group. You know, talking about actually, you know, talking to your fans, talking to your member base. All the stuff, we're in it together, and I agree, that's fantastic. But I think it's more the littler stuff that people are identifying that's clear to see out on the ground. You know, address it. Address it in that forum when you've got the chance to do that.
But if they don't, if they can't back up their words with actions, or if they don't know why they're going so poorly, talk can be pretty cheap.
How do you hold yourself accountable to each other as a playing group?
No, I understand that, but we keep seeing the same thing over and over again. So maybe they don't know.
Maybe
they can't execute it.
There's no doubt they would know. Absolutely no doubt. They would know what's going on. So who is the standard setter there?
Can they fix it?
Of course they can. It doesn't take any skill to go out there and tackle and apply pressure. That's just a mindset. That's a mindset of wanting to do that. A mindset of knowing exactly which players on the opposition have the ball in their hands most and making sure every time they get it, they're under absolute immense pressure.
Nick's given us a call early this morning, 1300 652 927. He's from Bendigo. Be pretty cold up at Bendigo this morning. Nick, good morning.
Yeah, she's not real flash up here, boys. Just wanted to have a chat with you. I've been a total supporter for my life now, about 40 years, and obviously the last 10 or 15 have been pretty rough. But I was just wondering, like, are they putting enough pressure on these players and the coaches for results as a board, do you think? Looking at it, they've got arguably two of the really good backmen in the competition. They've got two of probably the top dozen midfielders of the comp and arguably the best forward in the comp running around at the moment. And I just think of the administration not demanding enough.
I think it's a good point. That's where the frustration has always lie with me. You look at Carlton, when you see names on the paper, you go, they should be in a much better position than they are. So I've always said, you know, you want to wait until Charlie Curnow is back to see how that sort of functions in the forward line. But we're not talking about forward line. We're not talking about scoring. We're talking about the other side of the game, when the opposition have the ball and what you're doing. Because the reality is, and this is, I wanted to hear Paddy or Jacob Wiedering or Liam Jones say we're easy to play against at the moment. Because that's where Carlton sit, Whitey.
Well, it's an attitude and it's an intensity issue at the moment. And a sort of a, yeah, you can use the word hunger, but there's something missing from an intensity perspective, which is making a lot of Carlton fans frustrated because it's the same thing every week.
You can have any coach you like. That's your attitude when you go out on the ground as a player.
Yeah.
You can have Kevin Sheedy, Norm Smith, Ron Barassi coaching you, all in the same coach's box, but you've got to go and want to do that as a player.
Well, the interesting thing is if you use Hawthorn as an example to sort of compare with Carlton, similar sort of position on the ladder, Hawthorn obviously just a little bit lower, but after that insipid performance from Gold Coast, they've backed it up with two very strong performances against Sydney and Essendon. Not necessarily from a skill perspective, but from a purpose and intensity perspective, they looked a completely different team. Now, they had their bye to use as a bit of a circuit breaker. You know, there's been a lot of talk about boxing and all sorts of things that went on, but there is definitely a harder edge to Hawthorn, which isn't necessarily going to translate to wins. Mm. But I think if you're a Hawthorn fan, you're feeling a lot more comfortable about your football team than you did before the bye.
Everybody continues to tell us here at RSM when they're on, it's easy. It's the easiest part of the game to teach is defense.
Yeah.
When you're a developing team, when you're a middle of the road team, that's where your game has got to be built from.
Mm.
Carlton can score. They can score easily. We see that week on week. Their inconsistency lies in the defensive side of the game. Until they fix that, they'll be where they... You've said it all year, Whitey. They've lost to the teams that they've meant to.
Yeah. Really. Seven times a team has scored 100 points or more against Carlton. Now, it's not blowing out to 130, 140, but they're the only team that have given up 100 points seven times. Big Dog has called us. I'm sure he wants to talk about Essendon, but he says he also wants to talk about Carlton. Good morning.
Morning, lads. How are we?
Good.
Got a couple of points. First, I'll start with the fearless leader. I don't think you'll be having chicken soup, Rammer. I think you need a teaspoon of cement and, you know, a bit of hard help.
Look, he's very vulnerable at the moment, Big Dog. So we'll start with the chicken soup, and then I'll knock on the door with the cement later on today.
Fair enough. Second of all, who's going to fall out of the eight for us Mighty Bombers to make it? And third of all, how good is it seeing Carlton, Hawthorn, Collingwood and St Kilda on the bottom down there? It's amazing. It's absolutely brightening my day up every day.
Look, as much as those teams that you mentioned when I played the game were absolute biggest rivals, you still want, for a really strong one, a competition, you want to see those teams up and strong. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be making the eight, but, you know, having consistent effort and consistent performance every week is a good thing for the competition. I look at, you know, you look at Essendon and Hawthorn in Tasmania, and it's a packed house. If that game's in Melbourne last weekend, is it a packed house? I don't know the answer to that. Now, what was there? Whitey, 15,000 in Launceston. There might have been maybe 45 or 50 at the MCG,
maybe.
If that was normal circumstances.
Yeah, maybe.
Whereas when those two teams are both going really well, you know, there's 65 or 70 at the MCG to watch that game.
Yeah. So, look, we've talked about this a bit, and I know Rammer gave me a bit of criticism for suggesting that Sydney were vulnerable in the eight, but the reality is for the Swans, they currently sit in sixth position with 32 points, which is the same as West Coast, and a game further back to Richmond on 28. But Sydney's next four games, Port Adelaide away, West Coast at home, the Bulldogs away, and then the Giants. Yes. So that's the next four. So I think you might give them one. You might, at a stretch, give them two.
Their season's defined in the next month.
Yeah. I mean, they could easily lose all of those four games. So Essendon, they're still two games behind Sydney. Their percentage isn't too different. Essendon 103, Sydney 108. I still think the Giants and Fremantle are the teams more likely than Essendon to jump up and take a spot in the top eight. The Giants, 26 points. So they've got that draw. Percentage doesn't matter. Fremantle, 24 points, so the same as Essendon, but their percentage, the Dockers, is 91 to Essendon's 103, and then comparing that to Richmond's 105 and West Coast 107, Sydney 108. So, yeah, I think there is maybe, I mean, it says here on the ladder, Sydney 32 points, West Coast 32 points, Richmond 28 points, but logically I think Sydney's the only team that could drop out of the eight. Probably. West Coast,
yeah.
If they get more injuries again.
That's right. I think that's the other one, West Coast. We assume that they continue to win at home. Obviously, the performance against Richmond was terrific for them with limited players available. But I think Sydney and, to a lesser extent, West Coast are too vulnerable. We expect Richmond to find their mojo, and we'll speak to Shane Edwards about that later on this morning.
Well, let's go to Philadelphia, because Keith Pompey, who is the 76ers beat reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, joins us. Firstly, Keith, thanks very much for being part of our program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How are you feeling about life at the moment? It's been a bit of a tough stretch for the 76ers.
Yeah, it is. I'm just sitting around being bored. I was thinking I was going to write about the Milwaukee Bucks today.
Yeah, so take us through what you've assessed, the people you've spoken to, and how it's all come to this for the 76ers.
You know, I think, you know, some of it had to do with, well, actually, the Sixers had a great season. I think they may have, they had some injury problems. You know, Ben was got playoff games. He was scared to shoot the ball, scared to go to the foul line. And I think all those things culminated, and it kind of disrupted the flow that they had. And, you know, you can't play scared, and you can't be injured playing elite competition. And I think that's what happened with the Sixers. And the one thing I will say, early in the season, they achieved and they played better than what people thought they would play. But then all of a sudden, it just seems like they couldn't sustain the level that they were playing at once the playoffs start.
started.
So, Keith, look, from an Australian point of view, we're looking at Ben and the Olympic Games, obviously. If he chooses not to go and stay in Philadelphia and work on his game, how does Doc Rivers and his coaching staff fix Ben at the offensive end? Obviously, we know defensively he's one of the best defenders in the world, but offensively he just looks bereft of confidence and it just he doesn't want the ball in his hand. How does Doc and his coaching staff fix him?
You know, I think it would be one of those things where, you know, what they'll say is, look, Ben, whatever you did in the past, whoever taught you stuff in the past, you know, we're going to do it our way now. You know, it's like it's all about the 76ers coaching staff, shooting instructors. It's all about us. We're going to be the ones who are going to take over it. And I think the one thing that Doc was talking about was also having a routine, meaning, you know, like when Ben goes to the foul line, maybe dribble twice, you know, do whatever with the ball in your hands, to where you get into a routine and it just becomes instinct and this rhythm. Bang. That's what they want him to do. They wanted him to do it, you know, this playoff, but they knew that it was hard to do that in the middle of a playoff series or in the middle of the postseason. So this year, what they want to do is, you know, they want to, you know, do it their way. Like, hey, this is how we're going to, you know, help you become a better shooter. So that's what the biggest thing is. And they're going to help him build his confidence because, you know, as everyone saw last night, he just is afraid to get fouled. He doesn't want anyone to foul him because he doesn't want to go to the foul line. And he doesn't want to miss these foul shots in front of 20,000 people.
So, Keith, do you think it's more technique with Ben or is it mental?
It's mental. I mean, it's mental. The thing about Ben Simmons, and, you know, I've been covering this team. This is my eighth season. And I used to always get to the gym early. And I would sit in the seat and I would see Ben shooting three-pointers. I would see him go to the foul line and make three throws. I mean, you would just see it. It would just happen. And then all of a sudden, when there was a lot of people coming in and people looking at him, you would see on certain days he would miss. And then once the game starts, you're looking and you're saying to yourself, what happened to this guy a couple hours ago who was knocking down everything or 80% of the shot? So it's a lot of confidence. And I think that, you know, Ben's a great guy, a nice guy, but I think it's one of those things. There are certain people who just don't want to look bad. And I think, you know, he's more concerned with the way people perceive him than going through and doing the things that he's supposed to do. I think he just doesn't want to look bad.
I'm a big believer in karma. And after what happened a couple weeks ago, I stayed really positive, knowing big things were coming. I didn't know what was going to be, but I knew we're coming to a special place. I know I got my breakthrough win here, and it's a very special place for my family. And the fact that my parents were able to come, I got out of COVID protocol early. I just felt like the stars were aligning, and I knew my best golf was to come. And I have a hard time explaining what just happened because I can't even believe I made the last two putts, and I'm the first Spanish ever to win a U.S. Open. This was definitely for Seve. I know he tried a lot, and, you know, usually we think a lot about him in the Masters, but I know he wanted to win this one most of all, and I just don't know how to explain it.
Yeah, so in the last 30 years, Seve couldn't win it. Jose Maria Lazabal couldn't win it. Sergio Garcia's won a Masters, but not a U.S. Open. And it was John Rahm, the one to break through, number one player in the world to go with his first major. Ben Everill was watching it. He was walking the fairways. He saw some pretty dramatic action in the final couple of hours. Ben, good morning.
Yeah, it was one of those Sundays where too much was happening. I was able to sort of get across most of it out there, but brilliant finish by Rambo, as you said, just to slam that putt in on 17 for one, which is much more difficult than it may have looked to some people. And then to be smart enough to away from the hole of 18 to take away any issue and then drain that putt to essentially clinch the tournament. Just sensational stuff. And, you know, it's funny, it sort of was on the cards from before the tournament started, wasn't it, that might be the fairy tale, that might be everything pointing his way, but to actually close it out and do it, that's a whole other thing.
So, Ben, we talked to you about John when he had to withdraw from the Memorial six shots in front because he tested positive to COVID. So in the next couple of weeks, was he always going to be able to play in the US Open, or did things have to go well unexpectedly for him to even take his place in the field?
He was always going to be able to go there, but the worst case scenario was he was going to be cleaning up on tournament. He had to do at least 2 weeks in quarantine unless he had 2 negative tests 24 hours apart. And that didn't happen for him until Friday and Saturday pre-tournament. And once that did, he was able to sort of leave on Saturday from Arizona where he resides out of that quarantine and head to Torrey Pines. So he ended up getting the preparation of tournament week that he normally would have, but he obviously would have spent a lot more time practicing in the week before as well that he didn't get. He was able to sort of get a little bit more than he may have expected. But at the same time, he sort of relaxed him because, you know, he essentially had a ready-made excuse, and maybe that sort of relaxation was what got him over the line as well.
Tell us a little bit about him, the golfer, because as I mentioned before, he's won 14 times as a professional in 5 years, which is a big number. He kind of shares his time between the European Tour and the PGA Tour, but he's also he's a very emotional golfer, which is great because he's got personality and he's great to watch. But there has been question marks as to whether his temperament would hold up in the final 9 holes of a major championship. He's kind of been able to put that to rest with what he did yesterday.
You know, there's been basically a maturing of John Rahm in front of our eyes for the last 3 or 4 years, to be honest. You know, that Spanish passion and flair that he used to his advantage at times was also what would get to him. And, you know, I wrote about that last night and spoke to him about that yesterday, where he sort of knew he needed over time to work out how to harness that passion and use it for the good only, not necessarily the bad that was getting him in trouble. And he also says that being a new father, I know we hear this a lot, it's one of those tropes that come out, but the perspective of being a new dad, his son is 10 weeks old, sort of had him thinking about, you know, what he'd want his son to see him as. And he knew he's going to see the old clips of cranky John Rahm and club-throwing Rahm and all that sort of stuff, and he wanted to start getting things right. He sort of drew a line in the sand at the PGA, took that to Memorial, and as you mentioned, was leading by 6 shots with a round to go. And then even when the decision came down and the test came in, I was talking to his wife during the week as well before he won, and she said, of all the people in the inner circle, including herself, he was the only one that was super calm and chill about the whole scenario. So, look, it happened. This is the rules. We knew it might happen because he was in that protocol. We just got to move on, and I think this means that something big is going to happen. And he took that belief to Torrey Pines and won.
So, Ben, take us through the final round, because there was a fair bit that was happening. Bryson DeChambeau took the lead at one stage. Rory McIlroy looked like he was coming, and then had all sorts of problems late in his round. Why was Rahm able just to stay so calm through that round, particularly those last 2 holes?
Yeah, look, I think I counted it was 13 or 14 players were either had a bit of the lead or within 2 shots of the lead at some point during the final round. And it was just incredible how many came within a shot at it. And then at the end, it was literally a two-horse race. There was so much carnage. You mentioned Bryson with his... Look, he made a couple of bogeys on 11 and 12 that anyone could make over the two hardest holes on the course. But then on 13, he just had an implosion where we had the streaker come out there and, you know, blade a few shots. And then he had an 8 later on. We had Rory had a putt to take the lead, which was like, you know, 25, 30 feet. He missed that and then missed the next one, 3-putted, and then had a double on the next hole. I think you saw Mackenzie Hughes had a ball bounce on a car path into a tree and stay up there.
Yeah.
Colin Morikawa, he knifed a shot over the back of a green like that you would see from you or me. Like, all this sort of stuff happened, but Rahm just kept making par. And Louis Oosthuizen was doing the same. And so when it came down to it, it was those two, wasn't it? And Rahm said he knew that US Opens, traditionally, you have to just survive. But Torrey Pines is not a traditional US Open course in the sense in that last hole is the easiest 18th hole the US Open's ever had. So he knew he had to go after it, but he knew 17 was a wedge in if he hit a decent drive as well. So he attacked those two, managed to make those cuts, and the rest is history. Now, that's also what led to Louis Oosthuizen's downfall, who has now 6 runner-ups in major championships. he figured he needed to, if he wanted to win outright, he didn't want to wait for a playoff. He wanted to try to win outright. He knew that 17 and 18 was his chance. So he took driver on and tried to cut the corner a little bit on 17, and unfortunately, the end went in the ravine and was unable to get that pass up to go, and basically that was all she wrote.
Let's have a listen to Tony Cochran. And look, he was on AFL 360. It was on the couch on Fox Footy last night talking about expansion in the AFL. That obviously pertains to a lot of our audience down in Tasmania. Also, whether Gold Coast should stay in the competition. All those sorts of things was discussed with Tony Cochran, the chairman, the president of Gold Coast last night. Here's what he had to say.
Firstly, if you actually listen to my commentary, it's not aimed at Tasmania. My commentary is, and I'm living proof of it, I'll open up my books. Brownie, you can come up and have a look. The AFL as an industry cannot afford a 19th franchise. I don't care whether that franchise is in Timbuktu, Tailem Bend or Tasmania. That is my point. Right at this point in time, we've got, I think, 12 of the 18 clubs have significant loans, are significantly in overdraft, or whatever financial cover you want to put on it. So I do not believe that we're in a position at the moment to expand the competition. It's as simple as that. Well, Rui, what I did was I read the initial report written by a bloke, I might add, who chaired it, who 3 weeks after handing in the report went and joined the board of the Australian Rugby Union. I'm not sure that's kind of the dedication we want in AFL circles. And then I took the time, my time, freely to spend, I think it was nearly an hour and a half in a Zoom meeting with Colin Carter to go through all my comments and all my thoughts about that report with Colin. So I have schooled myself here. I do come with a fairly large business brain when it comes to sport, and that's been my way I've tried to make a quid for 45 years. And I just do not believe that anybody can convince me personally, and I happen to know many other presidents as well, that in the current climate, and what I mean by that is probably the next 3 to 5 years, we could consider expanding the 18-team competition.
So that was Tony Cochran on the couch last night on Fox Footy. Some pretty strong words there. Before we bring John Ralph in, Raymond, what are your thoughts on what he had to say there? He's good for the competition, Tony Cochran, whether you agree with him or
well,
not.
Well, yeah, he's very good. But what the thing with Tony is he's researched. It's not like he's just shooting from the hip and coming up with these comments. He's actually read all the information that's been provided to him, so he understands that. Now, I know he's protecting his own team. Of course he is. Because they're not going well. That's all for everybody to see, but he's allowed to argue that way. Not everyone's going to agree with Tasmania as the next license within the AFL if that happens. There'll be some that do, there's some that don't. He's passionate about it the other way. Now, he's got his opinion. I would love to see a national competition. I would love to see a team in Tasmania, and I'd love to see a team in Darwin. But is it financially viable? That's the question.
The interesting thing is, even when you read through the text messages that come through and people that call in the station with this program going to Tasmania, more are against it than for it, which is interesting. And then you've got the influential media figures like, say, Tim Lane, who's so passionate about Tassie. Yep. There's Nick Riewoldt. There's Matthew Richardson. It's interesting that it isn't clear-cut either way as to whether it's a good idea or not. So from people in Tasmania.
And Ralph, you will know this a lot better than I will. Both teams now, GWS and Gold Coast, this is the Gold Coast 10th season, so GWS 9th season. Both teams are nowhere near even close to standing on their 2 feet financially. You listen to Tony speak then. 12 of the 18 clubs have loans out. They're in big debt. Like, there's only a handful of clubs that actually make profit every year. So, you know, that part of the game, we're living in different times now. We saw the impact, obviously, of the coronavirus last year and what's that done to clubs and how they've had to tighten up so many areas of their own operations. So you know, we don't want to be in a situation where we've got struggling clubs continually for the next 20 years. We want Gold Coast and GWS to be standing on their own 2 feet. We want St Kilda to be able to do that. Western Bulldogs are working their way out of it. North Melbourne have almost worked their way out of it to zero debt. We want, that's what we want our football clubs to be able to do.
John Ralph from the Herald Sun joins us. Ralphie, good morning.
Hello, gentlemen. Yeah, 12 of those 18 clubs, as you said there, Rama, didn't make a profit last year and have significant debt. But 12 of those 18 clubs would have to vote for this extra licence, this 19th licence. It's that super majority there. And look, you know, I'm very big on Tasmania. You know, I'm a journo. It gives us lots of talking points, and I'm all about fairness. You don't have to be about fairness when you're in business. But you look at the Melbourne Football Club, they just lost $2 million in the space of 9 days in two games that weren't allowed to be played because of COVID in the states they wanted it to. St Kilda, $13 million of debt. You think those clubs are going to vote for another club? Now, because the issue is, as the AFL keeps threatening behind the scenes, okay, we might put out, let's call it, you know, $12 million by 18. So, you know, a couple of hundred million dollars per season for the annual distributions. We're not going to spend an extra $20 million. So that pie of money is going to be divided by 19 teams rather than 18. And so that's what the AFL continues to say behind the scenes there. Yes, those clubs, those expansion clubs are massive money pits, nearly $20 million a year. But St Kilda's $12 or $13 million dollars a year. And so, look, if the AFL did it, it would only do it in a way which would generate a lot of money. I think it would have to be by playing Thursday night football every week of the year and maybe by selling it off to a Channel 10 or to an Amazon or to someone like that. But I think it would need to be something, you know, really left field to generate the extra $20 million a year, because otherwise I just can't see it happening.
All right, so that's the latest there from Tony Cochran and from John Ralph. Now, Ralphie, you want to talk about James Heard, and in a way that I'm a bit surprised about this morning, to be honest.
Well, I thought to myself, you know, now clearly, you know, the way forward is not for extra draft picks for the Gold Coast. The way forward is for an extra $500,000 in the football department cap. You know, the powers that be are suggesting that that's something that is quite likely. But how do you get someone up there that actually, you know, either as a senior coach or as a senior assistant that actually wants to go there? Because you look at the, you know, the strewn reputations of those that have, you know, Guy McKenna and Rodney Eade and, you know, these guys that went up as the best and the brightest and just came back just absolutely shredded in terms of their reputation. I look at the way Justin Lepich spent a year in the media and he enhanced his reputation. I think if James Heard went up there and spent a year as a senior assistant or whatever that might have been, I think by the end of it, he'd be ready to, you know, step into a, you know, whether it's a senior gig or as a stepping stone to get back into a major club. Now, he might not want to do it, but his kids are, you know, are in that high school age. You know, Tom's at Essendon. It might just be the single way in which he can get back in. He's a very young man, and he's still a very, very good senior coach despite all that happened. It just, you know, the Couch Boys threw his name up, and it just tweaked my interest. I just think it's an intoxicating proposition.
Rama, you know James Heard very well.
Look, he had all the hallmarks of he was going to be an outstanding coach. The players loved him. There was absolutely no doubt about that. And he was very good tactically. Obviously, the rest is history now of what happened. I would love to see him back in AFL. I would just absolutely love that. Whether he's going to do that to himself and I guess open himself up again to that form of criticism, I'm not sure. I know he's very happy and very healthy at the moment. I only spoke to him a couple of 2 weeks ago and life's good for him. So I don't know if he wants to do that. I don't know if he's prepared to open his life up again to that type of feedback, positive feedback and negative feedback. I'm not sure, Ralphie.
Remember, I think about the coaching acumen and the tactical stuff that David Teague's going through. You know, you've lived it. How long would it take to sort of, you know, modernise yourself in terms of those, you know, the defensive methodologies, you know, the modern game plan? Is that a heartbeat kind of thing, or is that something that'd take him a couple of years that are, you know, as a senior assistant?
For Hurdy?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, he'll be still up to speed now.
Yeah, there you go.
I know how much football he watches, and I know how much he still loves the game of football. So, that would be almost instant, Ralphie. There's no question on that.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I know it's a left-field proposition. I know it's probably unlikely, given, as you say, that he'd be looking at the focus on David Teague and on the focus on Nathan Buckley and saying, why would I throw myself back into that situation? But, you know, it's time for some bold measures there. You know, I keep thinking about what Gillon McLachlan did with the Melbourne Football Club. So he got a West Coast member in Glenn Bartlett to become the president, who was extremely successful. You know, he got Peter Jackson in from effective retirement. He paid a couple of $1 million worth of debt. So it's almost getting to that stage with Gold Coast. You know, they've slathered them with talent, and that's all very well, but you need to do something for the backroom stuff. And look, if it's not him, I don't know. Is it Lee Matthews? He's parachuted across from the Brisbane board to the Gold Coast board. You know, it's not quite Mick Malthouse, you know, as a senior assistant there. You know, I think this club would love to keep Stuart Jordan as their senior coach. I mean, you know, obviously if the season continues to go really pear-shaped, maybe not. But, yeah, it's all about support, and that comes from the AFL, and it comes from really elite figures who will change the conversation there.
Ralphie, I think you make it a really good point. Obviously, the money that's gone out of the soft cap, and Gold Coast still aren't paying up to the maximum they can now. So we talk about money in the game for these new franchises. Gold Coast should be paying right up to that cap and probably more to continue to be able to develop these players and create. They've got to create their own environment. They're still creating a culture. At that football club, GWS is still creating a culture. But if you look at both of those clubs, if you said, "Well, what culture is better? Who looks like a football club?" You say GWS. So yeah. It's a tricky one.
Yeah, and I think too. I think the next 18 months, we've probably said this a few times with Gold Coast, but it is so critical because right now, people like Ben King and Lukosius and Rankin, they love this at the football club. They want to be there. They're signed till the end of next year. They absolutely have, you know, leaders like Tuke Miller and David Swallow and Jared Witt, people who wanted to stay there and, you know, need some help, but really are invested in making it a great football club. Now, at the end of next year, obviously, you know, it's the doomsday scenario, but if two of those three blokes walk out, you think to yourself, it's another five-year rebuild. And so that's why Gillon McLachlan needs to step in, not to just throw them another five or six picks, but just to get it right and to make sure everything they're doing is right. Sometimes just it takes a while and then it clicks. But other times, as we've seen with Gold Coast, they've had about 6 good weeks of football where Gary Ablett was getting 45 a week. You know, in 10.5 years, there's been a lot of misery at that football club and something needs to change there.
So, Raman, just the final one on Hurdy. Do you think he will get back into footy at some point to not right the wrongs of the past, but just to have another crack just to sort of finish off his football career so it doesn't end the way it did?
Personally, I do hope so. But I probably think it's more unlikely at this stage.
Carlton. Now, they rolled out the senior players yesterday. Three of them, Ralphie. We had Patrick Cripps. We had Jacob Wietering. We also had Liam Jones. Did you believe what they said? Did it feel like it was the right thing to do? What were your thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, I believe they're trying. You know, I think of all the discourse over the weekend, I think the one thing that just stuck out to me was that the lack of clarity. You know, you or I could try, Whitey, playing a defensive methodology. We're not fit enough, quite, and we're no good. But unless you actually know specifically what you need to do in lightning time, in real time, to make those decisions, you look confused. And then you take two steps forward, and then we saw that horrific passage of play where Whitfield just outran their stars. You know, Jones and Cripps and Curno and Walsh and Dow. You know, they're the players that should be thriving at this football club. I thought about if David Teague was out of contract this year, would he be any chance next season to be coaching? And I thought of all the things in the review that they will have a look at, the ticks or crosses. So I thought morale, well, that's a cross right now. Method in terms of game plans, a cross. Player improvement, you know, Sam Walsh is a great player, but, you know, he's a number one pick, he's self-driven. Cross. Development of the kids, you know, we haven't seen the Petrescu, Seatons, the Dows, those kind of players come through. It's a cross. Can he take us to a flag? Well, that's a cross. They have a crack meter, you know, in terms of the tackling and the pressure, that's a cross. The messaging, well, it's been mixed, that's a cross. And the one that they will think about is selling hope to their fans. That's a cross right now as well. And so, look, the review will bear all those kind of things out. But right now, when it's so clear that this is a review about David Teague as well as everything else, no one wants to see him move on. But he's coaching himself into a situation where it's almost impossible for them not to tackle.
Time to talk a bit of basketball now because Kyle Adnam has re-signed with the South East Melbourne Phoenix. We heard about Mitch Creek the other day and now Kyle is the latest to sign on and he joins us now. Kyle, congratulations.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Two more years, an easy decision?
Yeah, very easy decision from my end. Absolutely love the Heartland, obviously home for me, so cannot wait for what the future holds.
And how have you recovered from the final series? Obviously, it was played interstate. We couldn't get to see that terrific series with United at home. But when you look back on it now, with the dust settling, what were your thoughts?
Look, I mean, it was definitely disappointing for us. We believed going into that series that, we definitely could have won. And I think game two and three showed sort of where we were at as a group, obviously to come up. 17 points in the second quarter in a game three, and to lose that's really disappointing, especially after all the things that we'd been through throughout the year. And, it was an incredible season nonetheless. And I think, a team in its second year, very impressive to be one game off a grand final. But we know it's not unfinished business for us.
So, Kyle, what's the state of the rest of the roster going into the off-season? Obviously, Mitch Creek has recommitted. He had a player option, and he's committed to that. What's the state of the rest of the roster, and who needs to re-sign?
Look, I think I'm not 100% sure. Obviously, all the front office will take care of all that, but I know as a group we want to try and keep as many of our guys together as we can. I think one thing we've seen in the East Street League, the Perths, the New Zealand, United now, it's the ability to keep guys together and building that chemistry and core. And I think we've done a great job of that the past 2 years. And I think that'll be a focus of our club for sure moving forward.
And your imports moving forward, it's been probably something that it's been okay, but it hasn't been probably the best. You look at, obviously, the good Perth Wildcats. You look at Bryce Cotton, how lucky they've been with him. What do you think happens there next season with your import situation?
Again, not too sure. I think Ben and Kiefer were phenomenal, and if they came back, I think we showed that we can really push for a championship with that group for sure. So, as I said, obviously this will be left to the front office, and they'll do a great job of recruiting as they always do.
You've had a taste of Boomers basketball over the years. How close do you feel you are to being a permanent member of that team?
I still think I'm probably, a couple of steps away from being a permanent member. I've, got things that I definitely need to work on as a player. But I'm confident. It's definitely a goal of mine. And, I've always wanted to dream bigger. And I think the Boomers is really high on my list. And having a little taste of it definitely fires you up. But to be in those major tournaments is obviously an incredible thing. And I think that's number one for me in terms of my career and individual goals.
So the off season now for you, what's that going to involve? Are you going to have a complete rest from basketball? Are you going to look to play somewhere? What's the plan?
I'm going to have a rest at this stage. I think I'll be in the gym pretty much flat out. That's a pretty standard off season for me, trying to get up from 40 to 50 kilos. But just try my best to put on a bit of weight and take care of my body. Obviously, it's a long season, so. One thing, touch wood, I've always been, pretty niggle from you, and think that's a great way to stay, and that's because of the work kind of in the off season. So that'll be number one for me, and then just surfing down the beach, trying to enjoy some time away from the game as well. But I'll definitely be cranking to the gym work and stuff, and we'll start as a group pretty soon as the next season starting just in October.
We're into the Tigers this morning. With Shane Edwards, the Tigers are having their break, they're back, they're playing again in Melbourne. Life must be good. Shane, good morning.
Hey guys, how are we?
We're going well. Is it good to be back playing footy again in Melbourne this weekend?
Yeah, it is. It's, we're looking forward to it. Probably needs to get a bit warmer to fully enjoy it, to be honest. But it's good to be back.
Was it the rest the team needed? I know you've spent a fair bit of time on the sidelines with that injury, but just for the team to reset, because you've been kind of all over the place in the month leading up to the bye.
Yeah, I suppose we did need probably a week or two just to regenerate. We are living with each other for 3 weeks. Can sort of take its toll towards the end, and I suppose back-to-back Perth trips and living away from family, it can kind of build up a little bit. So it's probably good that we had a bye to finish that rather than coming back and jumping straight into the next round. So I think we got pretty lucky with that.
So, Shane, if you had to continue to live away with family, what would have been your decision?
Oh, I just would have kept going. It's once you're there, it's almost harder to come back because you're just in a little routine. So, yeah, just would have had to sort out a few things back home. So, yeah, another week or two probably wouldn't have been too bad.
Do you think some would have come home if it was another month or another 6 weeks of the season that you had to be away? Do you think some players would have come home?
Potentially, and it would have been no problem if they did. No. You never know when things pop up. The last week we're away, there was the blackouts and all that going on in Melbourne with the winds and the storms and stuff. So some of the guys' families were in the darkness and it was cold and, you're not there, and it seems like those things only happen when you're away. And, if just that little scenario, you just think, something like that happens, but it's a bit worse, maybe some guys would go home.
And I ask that question because you look at the reaction of last week or 2 weeks ago of Seb Ross and Tim Embry, and I look at the way St Kilda handled the situation. How would have Richmond handled a situation if two players had said, two important players obviously had said, look, we need to go home, we need to be with our family, we need to be with our young family. How would have Richmond approached that situation?
Well, I've dealt with that firsthand. Yeah. Last year, I stayed back from the hub with Basha Hooley because our partners were giving birth. And I suppose the best thing that happened was that I didn't actually have to make the decision. Dimmer and the club actually told me that I should stay back. So I don't know if that has anything to do with my football ability or anything, but they made it so I didn't really have to make the tough call. But I would have stayed back anyway, and I just got a lot of support from all my mates saying that don't feel guilty, all this sort of stuff. And, as hard as it is, you're back in Melbourne healthy, watching games, and you're feeling guilty as anything. So it's a tough decision, and, I don't envy what Seb Ross and Tim Membry are going through, especially with the negative media around it. I was very surprised at that. It seems like it's a bit of a no-brainer to stay back with family, but every opinion's different. So
Shane, with the break, does the team get together and assess sort of like a mid-season report sort of thing, or because you've been so successful over time, you don't kind of need to delve too deeply into things because you kind of know where you're at as a footy team?
No, we had a little mid-season review yesterday, and we just highlighted some things that were going well, things that we need to improve on, some also a bit of reinforcement at where we were at other years, which helps as well. How we had some issues, with things in our game last year and the year before that we actually corrected, and we tightened the screws a little bit. And without a mid-season review, who knows, we might have probably it might have delayed that a few extra weeks. So no, we're definitely pretty hot on the review, and we've got a few things to work on.
So 7-6 at the moment, going into the back end of the home and away season, as you alluded to, you've been in this position before. Does it feel similar to previous years? Do you think you've got a bit more work to do than previous years to get back to the top? How do you see things out at the moment?
Well, yeah, we don't like being in this position, starting behind and having to chase our tail. It's not something that we plan at Richmond, that's for sure. It just takes us a while to adjust to the game. And this year, I suppose, last year, this happened. There's always, obviously, injuries. Every team gets them. But the game's changed this year, just like last year with the shortened quarters and things like that, how you had to adapt to a few things. This year's probably a bit different. It's probably more ball movement, less stoppage, teams folding back rather than pressing up, things like that we just have to tinker with our game plan. And it's not like a big change. It's more just like a 10%, a change here and there with things. And, that's the difference with, being 9-3 or whatever, because we've lost two games by under a goal, and we've had our most giveaway turnovers for the year than what we've had any other year. So they're things that we control, and yeah, we're doing a lot right. We're just butchering the ball every now and then.
So just on that, you talk about turnovers. Do you feel like teams are playing against you differently now? And I say that obviously with the greatest amount of respect because you guys have been so good. But do you feel like, for example, West Coast a couple of weekends ago, do you feel they played differently against you to win the game at the end where you hadn't seen that from them before?
It's hard to tell. I don't really feel like teams change completely to play against us. I feel like most teams are probably just playing a little bit different to what they all played last year. Just with the fact that the man on the mark rule, it doesn't look like it has much of a much of an impact. But I think it's the difference between teams being able to press up and put pressure on the ball and just folding back and retreating. So you see the ball go from one end to the other pretty quickly, but all of a sudden you run into a bunch of numbers once you get up the other end because everyone's just folded back and almost retreated. So they're just little things that probably didn't happen last year because teams were so aggressive in the front half because you could slow them up on the mark.
Yeah.
So just those little tiny things that, you need to adjust to, and they're probably two or three goals we're leaving on the table each week just because we're licking our lips when we're out in the space and then we boot it in and it's, you know, Jack versus three rather than Jack one-on-one like it might have been other years.
Time to talk footy now with Rodney Ead on this Tuesday. He joins us every Tuesday morning. Rocket, good morning.
Morning, Adam. And Adam, how are you going, boys? Going well?
No, going very well. Going very well. Going a lot better than a few clubs at the moment.
it's sort of the season, isn't it? It's sort of got that demarcation line now. It's probably the top 11, top 10, and then the rest, the eight, have sort of dropped away, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure where to start. We may as well start with Carlton because we were talking about them at the top of the program, just about where they're at. I know they're a bit of a theme at the moment, but things aren't getting any better for David Teague and the Blues. What did you see on Saturday night that maybe disappointed you the most?
The thing that disappointed me the most, just digress, I hear a lot of so-called experts saying, oh, their system. Your offensive system only works if you've got heat on the ball and you work hard up the ground. And what I'm seeing is a genuine lack of intensity and urgency to put pressure on the ball carrier, which is basic stuff. Now, there's one highlight that showed where Josh Kelly's got the ball in the centre bounce and all the Carlton players have spread away and he's just been able to do a U-turn and had metres of space. You never see that in AFL. You never see that. You see the guy with the footy always gets some heat on him. So you can, and you, people don't criticise the Giants for their system, but they go one-on-one. They don't have this defensive system that all the experts think that every club should have. They play one-on-one and they defend quite well. So whatever system you have depends on your pressure on your ball carrier and your preparedness to work hard. The number of uncontested marks is a real blight on Carlton, what the Giants had, 138. So therefore, they're not working. They're just jogging. They're just jogging, handing over responsibility. So that, for me, was really mind-blowing and obvious that doesn't take talent. That doesn't take a system. That just takes players to be prepared to work hard to try and tackle and put pressure on the bloke with the footy.
So Rocket, you can teach skill, you can teach strategy, you can teach tactics, set up, all that. How does a coach teach attitude?
Well, you train it to start with. This is the way we want to play. So you do some contesting drills. You do drills with the opposition at the ball. You're saying to come forward to defend. You don't collapse. You don't go backwards. They get a goal out of the back. So you've got to pressure the ball carrier. And you put it as one of your non-negotiables. It's like turning up for training on time as a non-negotiable. Doing extras is a non-negotiable. Putting pressure on the ball carrier and going up trying to tackle and harass and hump, that's it. It doesn't take talent. And you know, Rami, you've played. That does not take talent. Yep. Whether it's Patrick Dangerfield or Dusty Martin or whether it's a first-game player, you can still do that. It does not take talent. And I saw en masse, there's probably 14 or 15 of the Carlton players who just didn't do that.
So how would have you handled the situation at half-time being the coach? There was 12 players without a tackle. So it was clear as day what they needed to do in that second half. Now, albeit they got within 12 points, but still they only had 41 tackles for the game. So how have you handled half time and those 12 players particularly that hadn't had a tackle?
Well, I think it goes back even before half time, Rama. I think this has been happening for weeks.
Yeah.
This is a culmination of weeks and weeks and weeks of players not tackling. So right from the start of the season and the way you're training, and you train your ball movement and defensive system, and but you also train what you value. And every team does value it, really, is about putting pressure on the opposition. And I think it's the most key stat, even nearly as important, if not more important, than contested ball, why you put pressure on the opposition. And if they have haphazard kicks, it helps your defence. If you let them just waltz through, like they did with Whitfield that time and Josh Kelly, they'll be able to hit targets. And so I would have made the thing, this is what we value, this is where we're at, get the players involved, they have a say in all that. But at the end of the day, if you're not going to tackle, you'd want to be playing really good football to stay on the side. And if you're not tackling and you're not playing well, you don't get picked, whoever you are. So therefore, at half-time, it happens again. Okay, well, you probably raised your voice in the previously. You don't need to do that. But this is what we need to fix. And players are putting their, careers or jobs or selection on the line.
Yeah. I know. Sorry, Ramo. I know it's never one thing. There's always a variety of different things. But should this pressure be more on the players than the coach? Or is it the coach's responsibility to get that effort out of them? Don't the leadership group at Carlton have to actually collectively say enough's enough and actually put up a bit more of a fight?
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, I think it's across the board. I just don't think... I mean, the coach sets the agenda. I mean, they want to criticise coaches for not motivating a team. It's, you know, there's the X's and O's and strategies, as Ram was talking about, but there's also the motivation as well. Coaches get criticised for everything, and it's probably their responsibility in many ways. But you're right. I mean, the modern way footy is prepared, and it's been going for a while, there's a responsibility with players. We're building leadership groups. They're having more responsibility. Players want more responsibility. They want more of a voice. Players want more of a voice. Yeah, we do this, do that, etc. Okay, well, with that comes responsibility and accountability, and nothing's happening. Mm. So I think you're right, and I think it's on. But so we don't know what's being said inside the four walls, and that's fine. We can only get a little window of what the coach says post-match and what players are saying, but they're probably going to have the same rhetoric coming out. But it's the actions that speak. So players have got to take some responsibility. They've got to stand up. They've got to grab it as a group and eyeball each other and say, listen, this is not happening. And Patrick Cripps put his hands up. Yeah, I'm not doing this, but okay, you player X and you player Y, this is what we want from you. Mm-hmm. So you're hearing it from your peers. So there is some responsibility there, no doubt.
So in all your experiences, Rocket, and in particularly your time at Sydney and the Western Bulldogs, where you had two really good teams, if you're seeing this as a consistent pattern, are you grabbing those senior players in a room and saying, look, you need to get to the playing group, or are you waiting for the players to come to you to say that? How is David Teague playing this situation at the moment? Is he waiting for a response from his players, or is he trying to drive the response in his players through the senior players, the senior leaders of the team?
Well, it has to be a circuit breaker, and I think if you're waiting all the time, you end up getting the same result of what's happening. I think you've got to go to the players you trust, and also the players in the leadership group, and say, guys, that you've got to drive this. You've got to be able, and hopefully you've had a system in, I keep going back to the word system, a process in place where players talk and you have a review, and there is some challenging conversations. And you know, Rama, what it's like. I mean, AFL footy is not a soft environment inside the four walls. And I get a feeling sometimes that with the modern generation, we've got to be nice and give them positive feedback. And well,
fluffy.
It is. That's the feeling I get. But you've got to be comfortable being uncomfortable. And that's because you're being scrutinised every week. You're under the pump in the media, and you find players who are going to not let you down in finals. So to answer your question, I think you actually go to your leadership group. These are the things you've got to find out. You guys have got to drive it. You've got to, because players will listen to players more. And I would think in that situation, you as a coach have already said things over the previous few weeks. Yep. So they're sick of hearing your voice. They're hearing the same thing coming out, even though you might dress it up in different ways. So they're really the leadership group have got to be able to stand up.
So, Rocket, we go all the way back to Friday night, and we look at, from a coaching point of view, the last minute and a half, 2 minutes of the Geelong and Bulldogs game. You look at the way Geelong were able to execute to kick the goal, but you look at the way the Bulldogs weren't able to execute to probably ice the game or lock the ball into that forward line. How do you review that situation with a team that in the Bulldogs that we probably think are good enough to win a premiership this year, but in saying that, they've now failed against probably three of the bigger teams in the competition?
Yeah, it's interesting, though. The last couple of minutes, as you said, or minute and a half, you should practice those situations. Goal up, goal down, what do we do? And go over it. So those scenarios actually have been practiced. Because I thought the Dogs could have iced the game a bit better and a bit even a bit earlier. And not criticise the young lad because he's got a bit of spirit. But young Waitman played on quickly and tried to pass the ball inboard. Turnover, didn't hit the target where probably could pass backwards. You know, spread the ground. Play around the boundary, get a boundary throw in. So there's lots of different ways they can do it. It just seems they seem to be playing a little bit more up-tempo than they should have. And I think the rest of the game, so the next minute that played out, I think Geelong would have practiced, but I don't think there was a situation there that you could practice. The ball was alive, so it was just playing footy. But they were staying in the moment. I think it was the experience, really. Of Geelong. They didn't panic. They just stayed in the moment, just... hopefully something was going to come about by just keep doing the way that they wanted to play rather than be panicky. And the opposition presented itself and they were able to take it. Smith's pass to Rowan was a good one. It was a good mark because it was under pressure and then be able to kick a good goal. So there's three or four acts there that you needed to execute and they executed it under pressure. With the Bulldogs, hopefully we'll be able to learn from that because they're still a relatively young side, but they should have been able to ice the game.
So much going on in the Euros at the moment. Stuff on the pitch, stuff off the pitch, and a dramatic win last night. An emotional win by Denmark as well after what had happened to Christian Eriksen earlier on in the tournament. Optus Sport is giving you all the action, and one of the experts as part of the Optus team is John Aloisi, an Australian football legend, and he joins us on the program this morning. John, thanks for your time.
No, thanks for having me on.
There's plenty going on. It's been a crazy tournament over the first week or so.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. There's a lot going on, and also we all remember what happened with Christian Eriksen, which was very unfortunate. That he's safe, he's healthy now, he's out of hospital, and he went to visit his teammates. I think it was yesterday at training, and they put on a performance for him and for the whole nation. It was a brilliant win for them this morning, 4-1. That gets them through the group stage, so now they're into the round of 16.
Yeah, and they play Wales, so they'd be obviously favoured to win that as well. Are you surprised that they've been able to, I don't like to call it a distraction, but with all that had gone on with Christian, that they've been able to sort of balance up and play the football they're playing?
Yeah, it was one of those things, you just don't know how they're going to react from it. Of course, during the game, that game there, it did affect them, and it would have affected them, you know, the days after that, but they've regrouped. They got together. They obviously want to do it for Christian Eriksen as well, and you know the whole nation's behind them. So you can feel that energy not only this game today, but in the last game that they played, and they put on a performance today. They were awesome, and so against Wales, they'll feel very confident they can go even further.
Now England's the other team that we're interested in talking to you about, John, because they've got through to the last 16. With still one more game to go. They've also got dramas because they played Scotland, who had a player that tested positive to coronavirus. So they've all had to test England going into this last game. And they're not probably at the top of their game at the moment. What are you seeing from them?
Yeah, they're not at the top of their game. They had a pretty good performance against Croatia in the first game. They got the win there. Against Scotland, they weren't great. They drew that game. And Billy Gilmour of Scotland tested positive for COVID. And now two of the England players have to isolate, Mason Mount and Ben Chilwell. So they won't be playing. And yeah, there's a few questions over England. There's a few questions on, you know, can they improve their attack? You know, who's going to get the goals? Harry Kane hasn't been firing. And so Gareth Southgate, their manager, has a lot of decisions to make.
So, John, who are you liking at the moment? So, Italy took all their points in their group. Belgium, all the points in their group. Now, Holland this morning took all their points. Who are you liking at this? It's still early stages of the tournament, but who do you think is in the best form as we speak?
Look, Italy were very good in their first three games. So they'll probably, along with Belgium, the pick. But, you can't go past Germany as well. They didn't win the first game. They lost to France, but their second game against Portugal, they really stood up and they won that game 4-2. But this is probably the most open Euros I can remember. There's probably at least six or seven sides that you think can go on and win it. So there's a lot to play still. There's a few games left in the first round. And then once we get to the knockout stages, you'll see even more dramatic games.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.